Welcome to the Payments Journal podcast. And here is your host, Ryan Mack.
Welcome to the Payments Journal podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Mack. Now, fraud is an unfortunate part of the payments ecosystem, and recent data has shown that certain types of fraud have been growing over the past few years, despite the current efforts made by the ecosystem. But why is that? Why are we seeing this rise? Well, to unpack that question and more, I'm joined by CSI's Director of Payment Strategy, Matt Herron, and Mercator Advisor Group's Director of Commercial and Enterprise Payments Advisory Service, Steve Murphy. So there's certainly a lot of data and insight to unpack on today's episode. So without any further delays, let's start the show.
So Matt and Steve, it's an absolute pleasure to have you here on today's episode, where we're really going to be doing a deep dive around fraud risk here. And now, Steve, I want to start off today's episode with you because we've got this fantastic chart provided by Mercator Advisor Group that's taking a look at just different ways that consumers have experienced identity theft, particularly taking a look at credit loans, lease, and bank fraud here. So perhaps maybe you could kind of unpack this for our audience here. And just as a reminder to our audience who are following along on Payment Journal.com, you're going to be able to view this chart in the article below. So, Steve, perhaps you could kind of unpack it and kind of tell us what some of the key insights that you're taking away from it.
Yeah, sure. So Mercator actually does an annual consumer survey ourselves, and it covers lots of topics, including fraud. Now, a 2020 survey had overall fraud increasing by about 10% from 2019. And that was true across various subcategories, including identity theft and so on, and account takeover. We have not dropped the 2021 survey yet to compare it to 2020. So what we did was go to the FTC data and found information for this chart that you're looking at, which shows similar overall fraud trends for consumers. Mostly on the, or more prominently, I should say, on the card and the lending side, but also directly into bank accounts as well. And so although these sort of fraud levels peaked during the height of the pandemic, you can still see that in 2021, they're at higher levels than before. So obviously, this is now an ongoing problem that requires greater diligence. So I'll leave it there, Ryan.
Perfect. Thank you so much for that there, Steve. So now, Matt, I do want to get you involved in this conversation here. So with this data coming from the FTC, and we're certainly seeing kind of the rise across these three segments that they're called out here, I'm curious to get from your perspective from CSI here, what do you really kind of account for this rise here? Because we're certainly seeing a lot of organizations coming with products and services to help combat the fraud, but we're still continuing to see some rise here. So what do you kind of account for that?
Yeah, you know, COVID is obviously certainly to blame for some of this to a degree. Policies and procedures obviously have to adapt to a contact-free world. More things are moving away from the face-to-face channels. But I think it's important to note the rise has been steady for years. This isn't a new phenomenon. Really, we see a large leap in 2019 as well. In recent years, the sophistication of perpetrators outpacing institutional procedures, in my mind, is really the primary culprit. We are just seeing a lot more people stuck at home who are open to perpetrating fraud or who are creatively testing and trying to feel out new channels that have been created in the wake of the pandemic.
So Matt, this is Steve. If a lot of this is consumer-based, do you have a perspective on corporate or B2B types of fraud? Is it trending in the same direction?
Yeah, we're seeing a significant uptick in phishing scams, particularly spear phishing. They're going after whales, big figures within an organization that have a lot of controls. Organizations have been mapped for years, so to speak, for lack of a better term. They're figuring out who the decision makers are. They're targeting those people, and they're using ancillary data from other breaches. We're starting to see things like insurance breaches, the various government agencies, but also other third-party vendors, to where they can target individuals with a litany of tactics, going after them with a medical procedure that they had several months back, talking them through needing to provide more information. I think the healthcare industry is incredibly complex for a lot of people, and navigating that is difficult. I received an email that told me, hey, my gallbladder surgery needed an update. They needed a piece of information to me related to a procedure that I had on this date. And I had, in fact, had that procedure. It's pretty convincing from a strategy fraud perspective.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, Matt, a lot of what you were saying there certainly kind of leads me to what will be the next question here, but I do certainly find it very fascinating just how we've certainly seen fraud itself, not necessarily the tactics that are being implemented, but just kind of a fraud from a business perspective, almost kind of evolving over the years. I mean, you certainly kind of had a lot of people have in that mind kind of that lone wolf situation, but one of the things I certainly see that's going on in the industry is really kind of almost that business mindset where you've almost got separate divisions within fraud where one individual's a mule, one individual will go and collect the data, another individual will see if that data is actually good data, if it's relevant data. You've got another in terms of what you were just talking about there, social engineering, another person who may test that data. So it's very fascinating for that. So that really kind of then leads me to the question of, from your perspective, how has fraud changed through the years and what threat should bankers in particular really be aware of?
Sure. So I think worse is probably the best way to describe it succinctly. Things have gotten increasingly sophisticated. Fraud as a service has really sort of taken off with individual actors increasingly specializing in their areas of expertise. We're starting to see turnkey services. There's Telegram pages that are dedicated to where their followers can literally, from a zero knowledge perspective, pay someone to engage in social engineering techniques when they need a certain subset of information that they currently lack from a target. So individual actors who are good at certain things have come together through various channels and started to really specialize. And so rather than trying to be kind of a jack of all trades, from a fraud tactics perspective, individuals can really focus on the things that they excel at, while leaving other tasks, other operational needs to other people who may be better in other channels. We're really seeing the full-featured marketplaces take off, 7x24 chat support, full warranty services with money-back guarantees, indexed search options by channel, geographic location, even specific institutions. So if I'm an individual who has had success with targeting a specific financial institution in the past, I can actually subscribe to that institution's channel, so to speak, so that I receive notifications and updates anytime a new supply of information meeting a specific criteria that I'm looking for is obtained. And so I'm getting an update from these sellers of information anytime they have new info from a specific bank that I've gone after in the past and been successful with. So this is an area where you want to think of it like inverse marketing. You don't want to become someone's favorite institution. And as they do better, word gets out and more people start targeting that region or that specific financial institution. And so we've really tried to encourage financial institutions to understand how sophisticated this channel is. If a bank posting something on their website about blocking certain transaction types, geographic regions, you can pretty much expect that information is going to be scraped almost immediately within a few days and added to their profiling. And so they're telling their customers, don't try to perpetrate information. Don't try to perpetrate behavior, certain types of behavior or scams in this channel, because the bank will block it. And so they're providing this kind of holistic ancillary value to their customers so that they can ultimately charge more. The more value that their customers are able to derive from the information they're selling, the higher prices that they can charge. And so we're really seeing a distinct shift away from kind of the lower hanging fruit of stolen static card information toward more full account takeover. They're attacking kind of the authentication channels such as mobile banking, one-time passcode, social engineering, et cetera. Really, from a payments perspective, EMV tokenization efforts to kind of secure the card space are working. The data is still out there, but it's definitely not as deep as it used to be. So there's definitely a shift away from kind of the static information, the magstripe data that used to be so valuable, and more towards authentication-based fraud, synthetic identity, new account opening. Really, probably the highest risk is account takeover.
So Matt, this is Steve again. One of the things that listeners may not be as familiar with is the term synthetic identity and the fraud thereof. Is that something you can unpack a bit?
Sure. So think of a synthetic identity as taking pieces of real information and establishing a credit profile or a kind of a profile from an industry perspective using real information, but creating it in a way or establishing it in a way that they control. So Social Security number was never really intended to be used as a piece of identification. So there's not really a lot of information such as birth dates. There's third parties that try to cobble together name and birth dates and other information around that, but not everyone is utilizing those. And so if you're simply authenticating someone based on a last name and Social Security number, you have no idea when that information was established or created. That information may come from a three-year-old or a five-year-old. And from a fraud tactics point of view, targeting younger people's information, kids' information, is actually a great approach because those people typically aren't monitoring their credit reports. Steal Warren Buffett's credit information, and he's probably going to be notified almost immediately. But you steal my six-year-old's information, and while I'm monitoring it because I'm familiar with these things, the vast majority of parents probably are not. And so that's really what we mean by synthetic identity is taking bits of information that really no one in the industry has established from an identity perspective and creating a new one that is within the fraud perpetrator's control.
Okay, thanks. That clarifies it.
You know, Matt, if I can, I want to circle back to one of the terms that you brought up. I thought it was a really good term there when you brought up reverse marketing. When it kind of comes to you don't want to be one of these financial institutions that an individual is able to kind of find a mistake kind of in the chain link here or kind of a weak link for it. And I certainly think that's very true and interesting because as you're pointing out, you certainly have all these groups within kind of a fraud organization that are really kind of almost penetration testing different systems to be able to say like, okay, did this work? Well, okay, that didn't work. So let's check that box and we can let the people who are looking to buy our services know, okay, you can't go in that direction. We've already tested it. And they kind of keep going through the entire system and they continuously keep doing that to check like, okay, hey, was there an update? Was there some kind of other software that just hasn't resolved this type of vulnerability that they may have? But really kind of with all that being said, that doesn't mean that financial institutions can essentially just kind of give up on it. So from your perspective, then, what are today's best practices to help reduce fraud risk?
Yeah, so you know, to speak to that, we've been using for over a decade the prices of our customers' information for sale out on the darknet in these various marketplaces. We've been using that as a performance benchmark. And so when we have financial institutions coming in and start launching our services, we often see their prices come in at a higher price point than banks that have been with us for a long time. And I think it's actually a great way to one of many benchmarks, but I think it's a great kind of KPI from a performance perspective. Because if you start seeing the prices come down, that's a great free market feedback that says, hey, you're doing a good job in the fraud mitigation space. And so the summation here is the well dries up in one channel. These people aren't going to just suddenly decide, I'm going to go legit. They got me. Let me go get a real job. I better update my resume. It's kind of like a balloon. Risk tends to shift elsewhere as soon as you squeeze in one place. And so account takeover, I mean, it can kind of result in a number of different ways. The social engineering techniques that we mentioned is obviously a major one. But sometimes it's simple as the common practice of reusing usernames and passwords across multiple channels and accounts. We all know that people aren't supposed to do this, and we can constantly tell customers you're not supposed to be using that. And I think even making them understand that for more secure channels, like financial institutions, we need to encourage a unique password, but monitoring your accounts for reused passwords, simple passwords, passwords that have been impacted in ancillary merchant breaches, it seems like you're constantly seeing different vendors, particularly over the last decade. And so the information is out there. There's the compilation of many breaches kind of database that has over a billion unique usernames and password combinations that is sort of the last several years worth of breaches kind of compiled into a single database. And so these tools that have been utilized to kind of botnet attack test username password combinations have become so simple and so readily available. The perpetrators don't necessarily even need to be an expert. They can simply load a database into a tool, click run, and over the next hour, they're getting a list of five, six, seven username password combinations that exist or that are working. And so that's where it's something that financial institutions need to be paying attention, but they also need to be understanding that this is probably not something they're going to be able to do on their own. And so partnering together both with vendors as well as information sharing, I think that's something that so many people have been hesitant to do even now. But in this space, it's critical to be participatory in the marketplace and go out there, talk to other institutions, share techniques and kind of trends, and make sure that we're learning about what's taking place. Because if you're not, that what one bank up the street or even across the country is encountering today, even if it hasn't hit you, probably only a matter of time.
So Matt, you had mentioned earlier the phishing, whale phishing, social engineering, business email compromise type stuff. What are you seeing that works well to prevent that?
There's always the trainings. I think doing the kind of continual penetration techniques where you're sending out kind of the training test emails, yelling nicely, but yelling, educating, I think is probably a better term. But in reality, I think we all know you're yelling at people who get it wrong. And if someone's perpetually clicking on things that they shouldn't, providing information that they shouldn't, it's better to know, better to do it to in a controlled environment than waiting for them to give away information to a bad actor. And sometimes it's escalating, force people to go through training courses when they're doing it on a habitual basis. But making sure, I don't think you can ever say it enough times, because I think there's always a percentage of people who just, for whatever reason, it's kind of how they're wired. They want to be helpful. They want to give the best experience possible to anyone who is coming to them for help. And so we want those people in so many ways, but security is one where, you know, we have to be careful. And so educating them both in the techniques that are being used, but also the kind of the why. So many people don't understand what someone can do with this type of information. And so really articulating the threats that can result as a result of giving away sensitive information, even when it kind of seems sort of seemingly innocuous. That's, I think, a critical piece. If everyone can understand both what's being done, but also the why it matters, I think it's much more likely to stick.
Yeah, it's interesting because probably everybody that's listening has had this happen to them. So this attempts are made on me at least once every 2 months. So
exactly.
it's a good thing to really keep on top of strange links and weird requests.
Yeah, sometimes it's just understanding that if you didn't initiate something, people aren't going to come to you for this type of information. No one's ever going to ask you for this type of information. And if you are ever asked, sometimes it's as simple as pick up the phone and call that person that is within your organization. And external links, if it's really important, they'll send it through a more secure channel. You'll get a certified letter in the email or in the mail. Rather, they're not going to be calling you and asking to pay your tax bill with iTunes gift cards.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. And I certainly think a lot of that is important. Matt, as you were pointing out, it's, you know, a lot of the education and the training and then the retraining to it, because as we know, like the fraud industry itself continues to evolve. It is that cat and mouse game or that chess game or however it is that you want to kind of take a look at it. So the fraudsters are going to obviously continue to evolve as they see, hey, this tactic that we used 2 months ago, 3 months ago, 6 months ago, no longer works. They're going to find new ways to try to help or to try to benefit themselves and try to create those penetrations that's going to create that revenue for them. But then from the payments industry, how is it that you see the approach that financial institutions and the payments ecosystem is going to take to fraud as it continues to evolve?
Yeah, so I think in my mind, it starts with eliminating as much static information as possible. I've had kind of a general heuristic. A merchant gets breached and shares static information, static card information, static account information. Shame on them. But when they get breached, you know, 2, 3, 4 times, CSI internally over the last decade has identified around 7,500 retail merchant breaches where card information was leaked. Shame on us for continually giving them information that can subsequently harm us. And obviously no one wants to go through a breach and really they're the victims as well. But we have to kind of embrace this reality that says we give information out there that can be stolen and subsequently used for fraud, it will be. Accept that, because the trends have perpetually shown that that's the case. And so we need to move away from static information towards cryptography, towards tokenization, embrace those channels so that merchant breaches become less impactful. And I think that's really the goal. We've seen a shift away with EMV. It's working. We've seen a shift away from card present fraud as a result of EMV. Card not present activity is still a channel that static information exists, where it only makes up any given month it varies, but on average about 35% of overall transaction activity is card not present. And yet it makes up almost 90% of overall fraud volume. And so that's a relatively new trend that's emerged over the last 3 years as EMV across the United States has taken off. The good news there is, based on our internal data, around 90% of card not present activity sees chargeback rights. And so financial institutions are recovering the vast majority of those losses. But that means those losses are being eaten by another organization. They're shipping goods that they're not ultimately being compensated for. So we don't want anyone to be on the hook for this type of thing. And so the goal really should be across the board, information sharing risk information through 3D Secure and that type of thing, but also just simply redesigning the ecosystem away, doing away with the kind of static credentials that are unchanging and can perpetually be reused, and towards dynamic tokens and cryptography so that any one transaction has a walled garden around. If I were to capture that transaction in flight or as a part of a data breach from a vendor, I can't reuse that information going forward because the next transaction has different values. And I think that's where we have to really continue to push the envelope and embrace.
Excellent. Well, so I certainly have to agree with you on that point there. So I think we'll wrap things up there. But Matt, Steve, thank you so much for this very enlightening conversation around fraud risk. And I hope to have you both back on the podcast real soon.
Okay.